From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Cokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The 2018 elections produced major changes in the national political landscape. During a recent visit to North Carolina, expert commentator David French offered his thoughts about the prospects for conservative policies. North Carolina government collects plenty of data. That doesn't mean the data are used well. You'll hear ideas from the state budget director about using data more effectively. The interim president of the University of North Carolina system has set out some key priorities. You'll hear them. And we'll delve into the recent legal challenges involving North Carolina hog farms. The state has rules regarding odors from farms. The man who once oversaw those rules wonders how they play into the current court cases. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Medicare for all. It's being touted by progressives as the next great idea to expand access to health insurance and medical care. But would Medicare for all actually mean zero premiums and zero copays? Our next guest has taken a look at the question. He joins us now. Dr. Roy Cordato is a familiar guest here on Carolina Journal Radio. He is the senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. Roy, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back, Donna.
We are hearing this phrase a lot now, particularly as we get into the 2020 presidential cycle. So what do you think you are hearing from folks when they use the phrase Medicare for all?
Well, first of all, let me say what they're not meaning, and that's Medicare for all. Okay. And what I mean by that is the Medicare system that we currently have. They're using the word Medicare, okay, because I think people generally have a good feeling about it. Right. They think it's doing well as a social program and all that. And in people's minds, Medicare is, well, you retire and then the government picks up your health care bills. But of course, that's not it. It's an extremely bureaucratic system. There are premiums. They can go up very high depending on your income.
And that's
almost
interesting.
$500.
That's an interesting point because a lot of people may presume wrongly that Medicare is, quote, free to them. It's not.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. As I said, depending on your income, you can pay up to $400 or $500 a month just for what's called Part B, which is for your doctors and so on. Then that only covers 20%. So the people say there's no copay. Well, if you don't buy supplemental plans, you're going to pay 20% of every bill. Beyond that, there are supplemental plans, which are mainly provided by the private sector, are all provided by the private sector. They take lots of different forms. But the point is that the private sector has a big role to play in what are called Medigap plans. So I don't think this is what people have in mind when they say Medicare for all. Let's take the Medicare system and just apply it to everybody. Because
it doesn't sound like a screaming deal, is kind of the implication when someone says I'm for Medicare
exactly.
for all.
Exactly. I think most people would rather say, I think I'll just stay on my employer's plan. But that's not what it is. They are using, or I would say misusing, Medicare. And I'm not saying Medicare is such a great system, but it is not what they're advocating. They are plagiarizing, I think, the word Medicare and using the good cachet that it has with the public to sell something totally different.
Is what they're really getting at a single payer system?
I think in their mind there is. Now, one thing we have to be clear, no one's being very specific, right? But the feeling you get is they want a single payer system, which means basically the government. They say single payer, right? What they mean is government payer, right? So the government pays everybody's health care bills, right? The government meaning, taxes. So, that's what I think most people mean. And often the implication is, as you said at the top, No copays, no monthly premiums. You know, you just walk in, you get them a card, you get your health care. There are a lot of problems with that kind of system, but that's not Medicare. It's not even close to Medicare.
What's the closest thing to single payer that we actually have in this country? Because there is a system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's the VA system. Yeah, the Veterans Administration system. And we all know the stories of that and the problems. And that is that's beyond a single payer system because that's more like the British healthcare system where all the hospitals, VA hospitals are owned by the government, the doctors get government paychecks. The nurses are paid for by the government. So that is that truly is socialized medicine. The VA system is socialized medicine, even much more than a single payer system is.
You mentioned the stories, the nightmare stories that we have heard about at least some VA facilities and mistreatment or lack of treatment of veterans over the last couple of years. There has been some pressure. I think the Trump administration has actually looked into this idea of trying to open up the VA system
right,
so that people have other options.
Yeah, it's kind of what we want to do, let's say, at the for schools, right? School choice. Well, we want to get one of the things that's being proposed, and actually they've passed a bill. I don't think it's been implemented yet. I don't know a lot about the VA system, but what the idea is to give veterans a voucher to go to private doctors to sort of add private support. Doctors to the system and hospitals too, I imagine.
We mentioned that this seems to have this cachet, I think, as you described it, amongst a number of very well-known progressives these days, including a number of Democrats who are seeking their party's nomination for president.
Right.
It was interesting that in the piece you wrote about this, which folks can read at johnlock.org, you referred to California Senator Kamala Harris. She at one point was talking about this transformation of the healthcare and health insurance system, and she advocated getting rid of the private health insurance industry altogether.
It's interesting because if you want a single payer, then you have to do that because then it's not a single payer anymore, right? I mean, the single payer is the government, right? So if you are also allowing private insurers, then it's no longer single payer, right? Then you have multiple payers. So it's kind of weird, actually, I think, to say, well, I want a single payer system, but I want private. I don't want to get rid of private plans. Well, how does that work? I mean, either you have a single payer or you don't.
And she even backed off of that statement
well,
that she made.
People.
She had some of her advisors or her spokespeople come out and say, well, that's kind of not exactly what she meant after rethinking it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that would be kind of a radical step for sure.
Yeah, it would. But everything they're proposing is pretty radical, but it's a direction that we've been going in for a number of years.
Roy, here's one thing that I just don't understand. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that is the law of the land at this point, even though it's there are some pieces that have been dismantled. But I thought this was supposed to solve all these problems about uninsured people and access to care.
Well, the fact is that the people who supported that, even President Obama, said, ideally, I want a single-payer system. And they saw that as a step in that direction. And a lot of us knew that it wouldn't work, regardless of what they were saying. We knew that we saw it as a strategy. Okay. We put this in place and then when it falls apart, right, we move on to single payer. And I think that's what we're seeing. It's interesting because it's mostly Democrats now who want to repeal and replace, right? I mean, you think about it. They're all saying, let's repeal and replace Obamacare. Now, what they want to replace it with is not something I would support. I think it would end up with horrible results, long waiting lines for healthcare. Like other countries, you go to Canada, you have to wait 6-8 months for an MRI, for example. I think we will see that in this country if we go absolutely. If we go the route, because look, if you make healthcare free, you're going to get a much greater demand. And if you don't do something on the supply side, in other words, you don't have a lot more doctors, right? I mean, look, you go to – when there's not enough people behind the desk at a deli, what happens? You have to take a ticket, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, that's exactly what would happen in the healthcare system because there's not going to be enough doctors to handle all the demand and so on.
Roy, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Conditions changed dramatically in the new year in Washington, D.C., with Democrats taking over control of the U.S. House of Representatives. What will that mean for the Trump administration? For the prospects of conservative policy reforms? Well, our next guest has some ideas. David French is a senior writer for National Review. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you have been a person who has been watching the Trump administration very closely, praising them when praise is due, but oftentimes looking at things that Donald Trump has done and said, you know, I don't really like where that's going. How is it going to change for him with a House of Representatives that's already inclined to be against him?
Right. I mean, I think the idea of a comprehensive conservative legislative agenda right now is pretty dead. Not just pretty dead, it's dead. but there wasn't much of a comprehensive conservative legislative agenda to begin with. Obamacare repeal mostly failed. I mean, the individual mandate is gone. Tax reform did go through. But aside from that, the proactive portions of the Trump agenda have been much more focused on judges, which, because the Republican majority in the Senate has increased, will be slightly easier. So expect the Trump Mitch McConnell judge confirmation train to keep chugging along without the Democrats being able to stop it. And then, you know, some elements of what I would call temporary regulatory reform. So a lot of people have praised the Trump administration for its rollback of some regulations, for its regulatory restraint. And I'm happy with that. But we all have to remember that everything he does on a regulatory front is completely temporary, because the next Democratic president can reverse it just as easily as Trump did what he did. If we want to have real regulatory reform, we have to have something far more substantial than a president either tapping the brakes or pressing the gas in their given presidential term. So I would say you'll look at a little bit more modest regulatory reform that is temporary. You'll look at some judges that are permanent, and then you're going to look at an awful lot of conflict. And when I say an awful lot of conflict, I mean it. And in other words, the Democratic House will rain subpoenas down upon the Trump administration like rain falling from the heavens. It is going to be very contentious. There are going to be multiple investigations. Think of it like this way. Remember how the House very vigorously investigated the Obama administration when the Republicans had control? The Democrats are going to do the same thing to the Trump administration.
I think I've heard the term subpoena cannon from one of the leading Democrats who's going to be in charge once that takes place. You have been watching the Trump administration closely. Do you think there is a lot of opportunity for the Democrats to come up with legitimate stuff, not just fishing expeditions?
The Trump administration is a target-rich environment for subpoenas. I mean, Trump himself, you know, has withheld an awful lot of details about his own personal finances to an extent greater than other previous presidential candidates, certainly to an extent greater than Mitt Romney, who was also a very, very successful businessman. Romney was far more transparent than Trump has been. The Democrats are going to want access to a lot of those financial records, and only more so now that it was revealed that negotiations for Trump Tower Moscow continued well into the presidential campaign, well after Trump secured the Republican nomination, and the same time that he was praising Vladimir Putin. I mean, these kinds of details are going to be fodder for a lot of investigation. And so I think let's put it this way. As diligently as the Republicans investigated Benghazi, I think the Democrats will more diligently investigate a host of Trump issues, from campaign finance and the paying off of porn stars to Trump's business dealings with foreign powers. You know, for example, it was just revealed that Saudi interests bought 500 hotel rooms at very premium prices at Trump Tower or Trump Hotel in Washington, those kinds of dealings with foreign powers, and then also, of course, all the Russia stuff. So when I say absolute downpour of subpoenas, I mean an absolute downpour of subpoenas.
We are chatting with David French, senior writer for National Review. Now, checks and balances are built in to mm-hmm. our system of government, so having one party check into what the other party is doing is not anything for us to be overly concerned about. What about this particular arrangement bothers you, if anything?
You know, the main thing I regret about the midterm losses for Republicans was that some of the better and more promising young Republican representatives who were representing some suburban districts that, frankly, Republicans need to have for conservative reforms now and in the future were lost. There were losses that should grieve conservatives who are looking to have a long-term conservative presence on the Hill. And I think that's, you know, the power swinging back and forth, there's nothing new about that. It's far more rare in recent history to have unified control of the government than it is to have split government. So the fact of split government by itself is not as troubling to me, at least in the short term, than is the identity of some of the folks that we lost. You know, Mia Love, I think, is a rising star in the Republican Party, and she's gone. Others gone. And so I think that's a problem for the conservative movement. Now, you know, people can run again and the pendulum can swing back again. But I think that's a real loss. And as for a negatively polarized country, I don't think there's any way anymore in this country that you can have divided government and it not be very, very, very contentious.
Some people are going to hear our conversation and they're going to say, that David French, he's a never-Trumper. It's all fake news. Trump's going to be successful and we're going to have a great couple of years. Why would you – or what would you say to them that would maybe try to convince them that perhaps – what you're saying is worth listening to.
You know, one of the things that I do is I will often ask, I'll put the same facts into play and I say, let's imagine that a Democratic president did these things. Would you be alarmed by that? Would you be alarmed if a Democratic president ordered his personal attorney to pay off porn stars in the closing days of an election cycle? And did so in a way that the Southern District of New York charged the attorney with felonies and the attorney pled guilty to those felonies. Would that alarm you in a Democrat? And the answer is, of course it would. Would it alarm you if a Democrat was involved in negotiations, business negotiations with a hostile foreign power while he was running for president and did not disclose that to the American people? Well, I know people would be concerned about that because I know they were very concerned about the Clinton Foundation's and rightfully concerned about the Clinton Foundation's actions that the FBI was actually investigating during the campaign. And so if you were concerned with the Clinton Foundation's activities, then you should be concerned with similar activities from the Trump companies. I mean, all of this stuff is – if you flip the party IDs, it begins to come into focus how we should feel about this. And this is – but the bottom line is when you're talking about people who have contact with hostile foreign powers and then lie to law enforcement about that, I'm not concerned about that as a Republican. I'm not concerned about that as a Democrat. I'm concerned about that as an American. And it is not at all illegitimate in any way, shape, or form to take a look at contact with hostile foreign powers, especially when people lie about those contacts with hostile foreign powers. That's just counterintelligence 101. It's criminal law 101. And we have to be willing to see the truth for what it is and react accordingly.
Well, we certainly, as they say, live in interesting times.
We do.
And one person who's going to be watching this very closely is David French. He is senior writer for National Review. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State government collects lots of information, or data. What happens to all that data? How does government use it? It's a topic State Budget Director Charlie Parouse mentioned recently to state lawmakers.
State government does not have a shortage of good data and a lot of data. But a lot of times, I think in this information age, we don't have sufficient operational capacity, really, in my office and maybe some of the other central management agencies, as well as the agencies themselves, we don't have sufficient data analytics capacity. If we want to have this greater tie to from strategic planning into budget and using data to inform it, you got to have the really, really smart people to pull down this data, to do cost-benefit analysis, to tie this together, to let agency leadership, CFOs, and program people better understand what you got and how you can use it. We just need to have more data analytics capacity in state government proper. And so we're sort of thinking about how we would go about doing that. Most agencies do have data analytics capacity in some way, shape, or form, especially our larger agencies like HHS and DPS have their own units, but some of our smaller agencies don't. And so we're thinking about how we can equip us and agencies with this additional capacity, and so we're contemplating that.
As Parous discussed the importance of analyzing government data, Republican State Representative Dennis Rydell chimed in.
The data and the analytics, that's kind of the crux of it all, isn't it?
Yes.
Because to make good decisions, you need good data. How many of our agencies are actually collecting the kind of data we'll need going forward, do you think?
Most, in one way, shape, or form, are collecting the data that we need. You know, some of it's, individual agency data. Some of it's data that we're required to collect. Most agencies and most of us, the data's out there. What it's not always in is in the proper format or capability to pull it down and to analyze it. And then to take it to the next level, it's not tied directly to our budget development system. And so that's, Chairman, really sort of what we're trying to work through, is making sure that we collect the data, but then translating it until how it interacts with our budget system. And that's going to take some time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not something that we can do overnight.
There's no formal plan yet to address the issue of analyzing state government data. Parous expects to discuss the topic in further detail during the next state budget process. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Dr. William Roper has shifted gears from leading one of the state's largest healthcare systems to leading its statewide public university system. Roper recently addressed the University of North Carolina's Board of Governors as interim UNC president.
North Carolina has been my home for 22 years. Public service has been my vocation for more than 40 years. This opportunity to lead the state's finest public institution is an unparalleled honor. The call to serve is something I take very seriously, and I intend to lead over the coming months. Some of the best advice I've received since I accepted this position is simply this: I should do the job of president for an interim period, but I should not act like an interim caretaker. The issues we face are too pressing for a caretaker period. I intend to keep this system's foot on the pedal and to do so for however long this board deems appropriate.
Where does the UNC system go from here?
We're one of the top university systems in the nation. We can and we will be the very best. Getting there takes stability, planning, and vision. I've had the honor and the privilege to lead some great public institutions before, from the federal agency that governs Medicare and Medicaid, to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, and to UNC Healthcare here. This isn't my first rodeo, as they say. And I believe that great leaders have a three-part role. The first is to chart a strategic direction for the institution. And this board and this system have done that through the strategic plan that you all have championed. It's a plan with the strong support of our chancellors, and it's producing exceptional results.
Roper says some of UNC's numbers look good.
The UNC system has surpassed its first-year targets in 11 of 12 areas. Areas like low-income and rural student enrollment, research productivity and critical workforce degrees, graduation rates and achievement gaps. I intend to carry this work forward, and I intend to continue our focus on accountability. Our strategic direction remains the same, getting more students from more backgrounds into and graduated from college, and doing so faster, more conveniently, and more affordably than ever before.
Roper knows he'll have to focus on more than just a good strategy.
If the first role of a leader is to chart the strategic direction, then the second is to deal with the external factors that can affect it. Public institutions must be accountable to the public, to the legislature, to their governing boards, to the media, to the taxpayer. And making the most of all of those relationships is surely my job. Being held accountable for our mistakes and our shortcomings is surely my job as well. And helping prevent distractions for those who do our core work every day of teaching, research, and service, that's also my job. There are a number of people in North Carolina who care about higher education, and we're very strong because of that. But we must have calm and stability, regular order and process, so that we can all keep our eye on our students, our classrooms, our labs, our hospitals, our communities.
That's Dr. William Roper, interim president of the University of North Carolina system. He identifies another key aspect of his job.
My third role as interim president is simply Management 101. It is to empower and give resources to the people doing the real work and then get out of the way and let them do their job. Yesterday, the Committee on Public Affairs and the Committee on Budget and Finance considered a strong, unified set of legislative priorities that will help ensure we give our institutions the resources they need and that we then get out of the way. And I'm encouraged by those priorities. They include a number of items designed to make this university system run better. And when leaders have flexibility, the kind of flexibility that private sector CEOs take for granted, they excel. With this board's blessing, I'm asking our elected officials to empower our system to rise to that level. I hope they will trust this board and its president to be held accountable, but to do so with flexibility to lead effectively.
Roper noted a change in the way the university is approaching its requests to state lawmakers.
Our proposed priorities this year are also unique. It's the first time we've presented a united agenda with our friends and partners in the North Carolina Community College system. And it's intentionally a system-wide agenda. It's not a grab bag of institutional priorities. We will speak with one voice in Raleigh. One voice united by the need to get more North Carolinians through college and to give them the opportunity that comes with a good education and a degree. As Benjamin Franklin famously said years ago, we must all hang together, or most assuredly, we will all hang separately.
Roper praised both his predecessor and the recently departed leader of UNC's Chapel Hill campus.
The strong leaders at every level, from the classroom to the boardroom, are why we are one of the best systems of public higher education in the nation. And I'm here today having followed some terrific public servants. Margaret Spellings is a friend, a visionary leader, and a towering voice in education policy. Our strategic direction is strong because of her and her team. And I know I speak for many in our state in saying I'm grateful she helped elevate the UNC system during her time in North Carolina. Carol Folt is a friend and an outstanding leader of an outstanding flagship who has stewarded and guided her university through treacherous waters. From where I worked at UNC Medicine and UNC Healthcare, I'm grateful for her unwavering support for the cutting-edge research and work we did together in communities large and small across our state. North Carolina owes Carol a debt of gratitude for her service and commitment.
Roper also mentioned a number of newcomers joining him in the UNC System's office, including a former legislator and former top advisors to a Democratic governor and a Republican state Senate leader.
They are Chris McClure, Pete Brunstetter, Jim Blaine, Dan Gerlach, Bernadette Gray Little, Charles Leffler, Carol Lewis, and Andy Willis. I ask you please to join me in thanking all eight of these leaders for stepping up and joining the already great team at the UNC System Office during this transition period. I want to thank this board and this system again for the opportunity to serve. I've had the chance to meet many of this state's leaders over the past two decades, but I look forward to meeting many more as I wear this new hat as your interim president. I believe education and healthcare are the pillars that can uphold and transform our communities. I believe it's true in our biggest cities and in our smallest towns. And I believe that the chance to serve, to play a part in making an impact for the people of North Carolina, is a great and noble honor.
That's Dr. William Roper, interim president of the University of North Carolina system, in his first official speech to the UNC Board of Governors. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Recent lawsuits over odors emanating from North Carolina hog farms have resulted in tens of millions of dollars in punitive and compensatory damages. One of the analysts following these cases closely is the former head of the state's regulatory agency that oversees the rules about farm odors, and he has lots and lots of questions. Don Vandervaart led the Department of Environmental Quality in the McCrory administration. He is now a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I thought that there was technology in place that would mitigate odors emanating from hog farms. Am I right or wrong?
Well, not only are there various technologies, there is a regulatory structure to implement those. And to get to your question, about 20 years ago, there was an agreement that at that time, Attorney General Mike Easley brokered, where the industry funded research at North Carolina State University to develop cost-effective technologies. And they did that, and they even have a number of different steps, levels of technologies that are available. At the same time, there was a statutory requirement added by the General Assembly to attack odors, and a regulatory scheme came thereafter, authorized by that statute, which was implemented by the Division of Air Quality. And that regulatory scheme is very prescriptive.
And in fact, what would happen, Don, then if a neighbor to a hog farm says, hey, there's stuff going on here, I can smell it, and this is such a problem that I need to contact authorities?
Exactly. What the rule provides is an initial series of requirements that every farm had to implement by mid-1999. But thereafter, if there was a neighbor that was unhappy, they were to complain to the division. And the division actually maintains to this day trained odor inspectors. And that's
incredible.
Possible.
Wow.
It's possible.
I didn't know that expertise existed, but obviously it does.
And they maintain their training for just this purpose. And the purpose is, of course, to respond to complaints and to thereby substantiate what's going on. The rule provides that if those complaints are substantiated, there are a series of steps that the Division of Air Quality will implement to ultimately prevent those odors.
And that gets me to my next question, because listening to you describe this, okay, there is technology and there is a regulatory regime in place that requires that technology and the mitigation of odors, yet we have lawsuits. So what gives?
This is my question. apparently, you know, and there's no reason why under the common law, a plaintiff can file a nuisance claim. What's surprising to me is that this is going on in a vacuum when we have a regulatory regime. And let's go back again. All the farmers were required to do certain minimal steps to mitigate odor.
So you must comply if you have a hog farm.
There are already requirements that they're having to comply with. For example, they have to ensure that when they spray irrigate, that the spray does not leave their property, for example. And then there are these additional steps. So the question I have is, are we to assume that these folks are in compliance? And if that's the case, did the judge consider that? Or did these complaints never get filed? Or did the division not respond, which I'm sure they would have if they hadn't gotten their complaints? So where are we in this very prescriptive regulatory structure? And what seems to have happened is that the common law suit that proceeded in federal court ignored these steps, and I'm not sure why.
That's the big question. So to whom do we address that question then? Because it seems very serious. And one would think that the hog farmers that are impacted or the attorneys representing those hog farmers would be making that argument, hey, my client complied.
It may well be that the judge, and there have been now two judges that have been involved, but the first judge was the one who found all these punitive damages in addition to compensatory damages. And it may very well be that the judge disallowed this information from entering into evidence for reasons unknown. And so on appeal, you're going to see, if that's what happened, you're going to see the representatives of the hog industry bring that up in appeal. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens next. There are still lawsuits going on at the district court level under a different judge. And there are going to be appeals going up on these previous judgments.
Don, is there any interest in the questions that you are posing among members of the current General Assembly or state officials or the current head of the Department of Environmental Quality?
There certainly is interest down at the General Assembly. The question here is if we're going to have a regulatory scheme that is designed to prevent nuisance odors, why aren't we following it? And if we're not following it, maybe we ought to ignore to repeal it.
What is a nuisance odor, by the way? Because is there a certain, I don't know, threshold of smell that has to be met?
Obviously, it's somewhat subjective, but the language that is used by the courts, in fact, is reflected in the rule. So in other words, whatever the courts think it is, that's what the rule describes it as. They use the same words. And it has to do with the interference of your enjoyment of your property, et cetera.
We know that the agriculture industry and the hog farming is vital to North Carolina's economy. But I got to tell you, if I'm someone who is currently involved in that industry or is thinking about getting involved in that industry, I have big time questions over, will I be sued?
Well, you know, this is exactly what you just brought up is exactly the reason that at that time, Attorney General and later Governor Mike Easley worked so hard to develop this solution, because it was a burgeoning and very valuable industry to North Carolina. And I think to his credit, ultimately Governor Mike Easley put together this structure that had been working. And I'm somewhat concerned that perhaps trial lawyers, in an attempt to gain large punitive damages, may have ignored this.
You have to wonder if the former governor, Mike Easley, is following this and wondering what's going on, since he worked on this and apparently did a lot of work and came to what the industry and regulatory officials felt was a good solution.
It would be interesting to know. I do know Governor Easley has maintained a very keen interest in this industry, and so should all North Carolinians. It's that important.
So, Don, what should happen going forward? You said there are going to be more lawsuits, and we have some rulings that make sure that people are on the hook for millions of dollars unless those judgments are lowered on appeal. So what do we do?
Two things. I think we're going to be monitoring the cases as they go on through the district court level, and I know that some of the attorneys there are aware of this question, and hopefully if a judge has – the earlier judge ignored this, maybe the current judges will not. Similarly, in the appeals process, hopefully they'll take a look at this.
We've been talking with Don Vandervaart. He is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. You can read all of his writing on this issue and others at johnlocke.org. Also, he published an op-ed about this subject in the Raleigh News and Observer. You can find it on their website. He is the former secretary of the Department of Environmental Quality. He served during the Pat McCrory administration, now with the John Locke Foundation. Don, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. We appreciate you listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.